From NBI Studio, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Roth. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for Season 12, Episode 5, A Broader Look. In this week's episode, we dug much deeper into the victimology, specifically of John and Vicky, plus a little more about Becky. We had a lot of new information in this one. It generated a lot of discussion. Janet, who's joining me via Zoom, said she has a bunch of questions and notes herself. And Zach, who's sitting across from the table from me, has a notepad in front of him. We've got a ton of questions from you. So right after a break, we'll get right into them.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications. And that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just Say You're Sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we are back, everybody. We have so much to talk about today. But before we dive deep into this latest episode, I do need to check how your live show went. It happened. Bob, how was it?
It happened. It was an absolute blast. We had just over 100 people, which was a lot, but it was a little, we discussed on stage how Kelly and the captain, when they scheduled this, nor did I notice, none of us noticed that it was the night before Easter.
Yes.
Which based on our messages, I think we would have had probably another couple hundred more had it not been a holiday weekend, but it was fun. I think everybody, there was a lot of people in our YouTube chat that were there. Everybody seemed to really like it. It was a solid 2-hour show. We literally laughed and cried, and Kelly's a rock, by the way. Captain and I both cried at one point on stage, and then we all laughed a lot. Kelly was a why Captain and I are sobbing on the other side. She's just, I think she said, she's like, I guess I'm just a cold-hearted bitch because I don't see it. And Kelly, who was our new editor, who's editing this. So hey, I want to say too, when you guys listen to this, if anything's not quite how it normally sounds, this is literally Kelly's very first episode that she's editing.
So you're going to want to write her and at her, at Kelly. No, I'm totally kidding. Do not do any of those things.
If you don't like it, make sure send all of your complaints right to Kelly. No.
No complaining.
But yeah, so just be aware of that. We have a new editor. It's a very complicated process, so things don't sound exactly like that. And I know all of you are very compassionate people and wouldn't give her a hard time anyway. But yeah, the show was amazing. We had an absolute blast. Captain and I wasn't planned, probably a 45-minute, I would say this close to heated debate over the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Really? Oh, I'm so mad I missed it. I mean, there was no way I could get there, and it was Easter weekend. What were you thinking? But no. No, I'm so curious. Did you guys record it at all? Is that something that any of us can listen to a version of or anything?
We did, and I think that we're going to, I don't have the audio link yet, but I think that we're going to release, probably release the audio version on True Crime Binge. And then there is a video that they said it's going to take a few weeks to get to us. And my thought were, since all of you who are on Patreon are so kind to help support us and do stuff like that and couldn't make it to the show, that we'll probably put the video version on for all the patrons to be able to watch.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Yep.
So I want to know the more important news for this. Did anybody confuse you with the captain?
No, despite you trying to make that happen.
That's disappointing. I really did try.
I'm telling you, if I can get it done between now and CrimeCon, I'm going to put together a chart, a Zach Bob Captain ID chart. So if anybody that comes across a large, bearded, tattooed man, so they can help distinguish and know who's Zach and who's Bob and who is the captain. So
great.
That'll be fun.
I think it's really funny.
I hope it happens. I love it.
Yep. So yeah, live show was great. We walked away saying, let's do more. So we're already right now looking at putting one together for Indianapolis probably sometime this summer.
Oh,
they'll
nice.
Be on the lookout for that.
Outstanding. Well, yeah, keep us posted. And you also were doing that show knowing that you were dropping a doozy of an episode for the listeners to check out. Yikes. There's a lot that you revealed to us in this last episode. I was pretty intrigued. And I know we got a ton of great questions.
Before we get into those listener questions, you have the floor for a couple minutes for any thoughts, any Janet thoughts?
Well, and Zap too. What did you think, buddy? Were you as blown away as I was by some of the stuff, especially knowing that there were audio files that just didn't have any written accompaniments, no write-ups, nothing you saw, right, Bob, that was sort of breaking down? That's why you had to go through everything and listen to it. The idea of just happening upon
right.
that stuff seemed kind of amazing to me, right, Zap?
Well, yeah.
I said right, Zap.
Right, I heard you.
That's how it goes.
Listen, I tried to make you talk first. You already put it on Zach, so I'm taking it back and I'm sending it back to you.
I'm bringing him in. I want to know what he thought.
But yeah, just to clarify that, yeah, so I've gone through the police reports in the chronological order, and I'm like, they haven't, originally, and I'm like, they didn't look into any kind of victimology about John and Vicky at all, like I had said earlier. Then I have this list of all these police interviews that I converted them all to a format that I was able to listen in. And then I just had these names, and like literally would do like a search through the police file to see, okay, who is this person, trying to find a report attached to it. And there's nothing. And so I just would listen to them. And then it's like, oh, that's John's boss. This is interesting.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's how those came about.
Wow.
Your thoughts, Zach?
It was almost comical that these had no reports to them. I mean, and mm-hmm. I say that, I don't say that lightly, and I'm not trying to make light of it, but it's crazy to me that they had all these audio files and nothing came of it. And I came into the episode really trying to be open-minded. Like, I tried to put aside the things we already know.
Mm-hmm.
Robert, at this point, should be a suspect.
Agreed.
Rightfully
yep.
so, should be a suspect. But I tried to put that aside right now. I just want to hear what we have out of these interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot there. They're really, I mean, John's boss, Tim,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he really came out with a lot of information that I didn't expect. One of the biggest things I took away... There's many things I took away, but one of the biggest things I took away was the fact that he said that John made $60,000 to $70,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
I would never have suspected that in the slightest bit.
Yeah, all we've heard is that they were broke all the time.
Yeah, that he was broke. And then, they would also say that he couldn't make it through the weekend without needing his check.
Mm-hmm.
When there was times, it didn't sound like he needed one recently, but there was times where he needed advancements. He's just hemorrhaging money somewhere.
Yeah, and there's a web there too and stuff. I couldn't fit it all into the episode. And some of the audio is so bad that it's really like Mike did a good job cleaning up some of these to make them, and they still weren't great, but he made them listenable. But yeah, the interviews with some other people, like neighbors around the scene that talked about the like three different people called them recluses.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go out, they come home, they stay home, they keep to themselves. So it's like, and some of them are the ones that say that, but he's done work for me and he's done work for my neighbor and my son. He does a lot of other work. That's all he's saying is like, so he makes that much money. We know I actually do have their bank records. Their mortgage payment was like $900 a month. And they're both working. They don't seem to ever go out. They don't have new cars or car loans. Where the hell is all the money going?
Yeah, it's strange. And, you kind of touched on gambling. I don't know how much gambling is involved. Obviously, we don't know unless we know his habits. We touched on the one thing where they kind of had like an NFL bet. A lot of people do that. That's really not. I mean, I understand that is technically gambling, but a lot of people do that. And I wouldn't say they're gamblers because they do that.
My point was that we can't say that he's not a gambler because anecdotally, Tim thought, well, he's not a gambler because he didn't even get in the pool this year.
Right. That's true.
Like I think that's still an unknown factor. But then you have the fact that according to his neighbors, that once he goes, they're just home all the time. He doesn't go anywhere. You'd think he'd be like out at a casino somewhere or something if there was a gambling issue. But we definitely don't know.
I mean, that's quite a bit of money to just have to have advancements for. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It just seems crazy to me that he's literally hemorrhaging money. Where is it going?
Right.
Obviously, he wasn't paying his ex. He just recently started paying his ex. So that's
right.
It wasn't going there.
Mm-hmm.
I had to go back and listen to the very first episode of this season in which you laid out a bunch of stuff that at the time, it sort of sinks in, but it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing as when you get additional information. So I went back and listened to you kind of talking about what you had found out at that point about, the tax lien and, wondering mm-hmm. about John. And it was very interesting to hear you talking about the rumors about Ron and the fact, and, you know, you even said it seems unlikely that he would be angry about the boyfriend moving into this house. It was so many years ago. So it's very interesting to see how some of the stuff is kind of unfurling and indicating itself. And also, it felt like the cops in some of these interviews, it felt like they were really asking good questions that were sort of guiding towards investigation that would maybe happen, you know? So that's what's interesting to me. Yeah. It's like they got a lot of information. And at the time they were present to following up and asking questions like, why do you think that happened? What? Tell me more about the money. So the idea that there isn't any paperwork to follow this up really makes me feel like, is there paperwork? And it's just not in this file. Like either way, it's not good. Either it's missing for a reason and that's not good, or there isn't any and that's not good.
Well, we get a little insight into that. So one of the things that was irritating me was, so this is a triple homicide investigation where you have to gather evidence, and John's, must have been the wife or the daughter that was in the room, was like, oh yeah, I can get you his 1099s and his payroll receipts. I can make copies of all that. And the detective says, oh, I don't need copies. Just tell me.
Right.
I'm like, what the hell do you mean you don't need copies? Just tell me. That was insane. I want to point, so Teresa Dunn in the YouTube chat wants to know if I actually just found those interviews or these recordings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Kind of jumping back to what you said, the things that were kind of foreshadowed in the first episode. Yeah, I mean, I knew the recordings were there, but I hadn't listened to them yet. I had only listened to the interviews for the people who I knew who they were, thinking that as I got further into the police file, then I would, you know, start to see where the police were going and why the other ones were there. So no. But like you had mentioned, like the tax lien, you know, that indicated to me that there was some sort of issue. There was another interview with one of John's coworkers that I didn't play that did say that John had talked to him about how he's trying to pay off some IRS debt. So I think I was right about that, that the debt wasn't the child support, I don't think, mm-hmm. even though that was one of the options. But it sounds like his ex-wife wasn't pursuing that money. So he wasn't real too concerned about it. But it does make sense why he was trying to keep his money off the books.
And Zap, what did you think about the ex-wife's interview, the idea that the kids got together, that they actually got together and were trying to come up with what could have maybe happened, and they came up with those three things? What do you think about that?
I don't know. You know, it's hard to fathom what happened and how they kind of brought those ideas together. I guess I'm a little confused on that part of the interview, I guess, listening to their ideas of how things could have happened. And bringing the kids together, I just don't know.
Yeah.
Well, as far as like the money owed from Ron, and one thing that I took out of those was Chuck. And I had to go back and re-listen to the first interview mm-hmm. because, you know, they say that, you know, Becky had moved in with Chuck, who was a boyfriend between Ron and John, which after she divorced Ron, there was this Chuck that must not have lasted very long. And then there was John. And because her friends had all said she went to live with her dad,
mm-hmm.
which then I'm like, did she see him as like a father figure? There's a whole lot of things that questions that raises about a relationship with her dad to me. But then I went back and listened to the first interview, and we sort of get confirmation of that when the boss says, yeah, her senior year, she had moved down and she wasn't staying with her biological father. It was like an ex-boyfriend of Vicky's that she was staying with.
We have a lot of questions about kind of past relationship stuff, and I think looking for clarification on that from our listeners. Do you want to dig into some of that and any remaining
stuff? Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, great. Let's actually start out, if you don't mind, with the money, because there was a lot of feedback and questions that came from mm-hmm. this idea of the $175,000.
That really jumped out to me as well. And it was a very specific number. I mean, they said it multiple times. It wasn't a guessing number that they came up with. It was a number that they knew that had been told to them multiple times.
Right.
So it's strange. Do we know anything about where Ron's pension came from and what that payout would be?
Well, we know that he was a sheriff and he was retired, so he had a pension coming. The arrangement is not uncommon, being a fireman mm-hmm. for years. And I knew several firemen who went through divorces and lost part of. Of course, I went through a divorce as a fireman, but my wife was a teacher who also had a pension. So we were both just kind of like, you keep yours, I'll keep mine. But it's not uncommon for them to get half of that and it doesn't get paid out until they retired. In California specifically, I think it's nationally, it's called a QRA. It's like QR. There's an abbreviation as far as how the law that defines once a court orders that, how it gets paid out later. I believe it's federal law.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where the pension came from.
So that's what I'm getting at, I guess, is they kept calling it inheritance. Do we know if that's if it was truly an inheritance, or do we think it's part of that pension payout?
I said that I assume that that was...
Jason called you out for it, understandably.
Go ahead and read Jason's question.
Well, Jason said, and this is a similar sentiment from Christine, like you were saying, Zap, wondering about this idea of friends seeming so sure it was an inheritance as if someone had passed away, versus this idea of it coming directly from Ron. So Jason says, you know, the word assume was used again in this episode. One can only assume that this was the $175,000. That's a quote from Jason of what you said. Not a fan of assumptions. He says, since you already stated it wasn't in the records about where that money was coming from, how can we shore it up so that it isn't an assumption? I agree. $175,000 owed a year after retirement is a red flag and opens up a whole ton of potential questions about Ron and any financial pressure he may have been under. So people looking for that clarification. Can we stop assuming? How can we find out if it's the real thing?
I can't argue with the sentiment, Jason, that I don't like assumptions either. I threw that in because I want to make sure I'm clear as to point out that we don't know that's where it came from. Mm-hmm. The evidence, the circumstantial evidence seems to be pointing that direction, that they're all saying they're coming into this large sum of money and it's coming from someone on Vicky's side. They think it's an inheritance they're getting, and maybe John even told them it's an inheritance. And then we find out, oh yeah, from John's ex, that she had a large sum of money. She said substantial amount of money that was coming from Ron that he was fighting in court and didn't want to pay. And we go back and listen again to that first interview, and you hear him say that they've been having trouble getting it, but they think that they're about to finally get this large sum of money. So it would seem like probably that's in again, I don't disagree with you, Jason. I don't like assumptions either. But it would seem like those dots sure seem connected unless there's another inheritance coming somewhere that she's also having a hard time getting.
Just to throw a monkey wrench into it, Valeria pointed out that the detective says the family didn't know about the source of the $175,000.
Right.
And that John and Vicky hadn't seen them since Christmas. So I think a lot of us, like Valeria, are wondering, okay, so who's the family and why don't they know what that money is, if that's what he's saying?
Right. Yeah. And that's another reason why I thought it seems unlikely that it was an actual inheritance, because that would seem like something that the family, I would think, would be the surviving daughters and John's surviving children, I would guess, or who the family is. And then John had a couple of sisters, too, that I listened through their interviews. Mostly they're talking with them. They're talking about DNA being used for comparison to try to identify the body. Yeah. So again, that adds more to it to me that if someone died who was, you know, wealthy to an extent and was going to leave them this money, it would seem like the family would probably know about that, I think. But I can't get us past assumption unless I can find the actual records. And that gets real hard because California has some very strict privacy laws. And so if the police didn't investigate it, it's not in the file. It's very difficult for me to get it. I'm working on it. I'm searching through trying to find out.
It almost seems like because he was a public service, I don't know, sorry to interrupt, but in my mind, all of a sudden I thought, well, he is, if we're quote unquote paying his salary because he was a sheriff, maybe there's something
right
there. I don't know.
You'd think so, but this it would be a civil issue probably personally between him. And, you know, he would probably have to file some sort of motion if he was actually fighting it in court. Like the ex said, he would have to file a motion with a judge basically saying, so the federal government, for the federal laws lay out exactly how that money has to be paid. So my guess is if he was fighting it in court, what he was fighting was maybe an appeal to the judge's ruling from the divorce saying that she shouldn't be getting half of his pension because of X, Y, and Z. And it could be, and I'm completely speculating here, I just want to make that clear. There may have been a clause. I've seen clauses that say if the spouse remarries, then she doesn't get it. And he could be making an argument of, well, they've been living together for 10 years. They're common law married. You know, who knows?
So whether it's a settlement or an inheritance, we don't know where it's coming from, but we can lean pretty heavily on the fact that we believe it's going to Vicky, not
right,
John.
Both interviews say that it's going, and there's more. I started to say there's more from the daughters that they were aware of the fact that Vicky was owed this money from Ron, and that he was going to be using some of it to try to catch up his back child support, which was really just, it sounded like he, I mean, you know, she wasn't fighting for that, but he was just trying to make it right and catch those back child support payments up.
Well, and it seemed like they had a pretty good relationship.
Yeah, at least friendly enough that she said, I heard her say that the John's daughters and Vicky's daughters had dance classes together, and she talked to Vicky sometimes. So yeah, it doesn't seem like it was a very hostile.
Well, and if they're close enough that Vicky is telling her things about Ron, like right. about their right. previous relationship, they obviously have a pretty solid relationship. To me, it seems like, because I don't think you just spew that to anybody, even if it is your, you know, your partner's ex or whatever it may be.
Right.
Certainly the way she presented it to the police, at least, she even said, like, I wasn't really pursuing it. You know, he was taking care of that family. So there was a sense of kind of, he's not a bad guy. That money may have been going towards helping support these other kids that she has a relationship right. to as well. Going into those accounts and more conversations again about money, Christine wants to know, were John and Vicky's bank accounts looked at? Amanda has the same question. Do we have proof of banking statements? I'm just kind of lumping these together. Christine says, John strikes me as the type of person who might not always use banks. If they came into cash, is there evidence they had it in the bank, or would they have kept some at home? If they weren't shy about talking about the fact that they were coming into money and people suspected there might be cash at the house, etc. Good question. Mm-hmm. And Autumn also says, did John have a legal entity pursuing him for the unpaid child support? That would be a solid reason to cash a check instead of depositing it into an account. So all that kind of around, could there have been cash in the house? And do we have bank account statements?
So as far as the legal entity, no. There's the way child support works is typically if the party owed the child support is not pursuing it. The, you know, the child support, the people that were in Michigan, is called friend of the court. It's called different, you know, things in different states. But the people that work in those divisions are so busy with so many thousands and thousands of cases, they're not going out poking around for trouble unless there's, you know, a parent coming in saying, I want to take this person to court. So there was no legal entity there. But we do know that he had multiple tax liens. And with the tax liens, they probably would be attached to his bank account, where stuff could be taken right out of his account, possibly, if they had some sort of garnishment on there. The way the tax liens work is really it's when you file your tax return, they get it.
Right.
So that would be one reason. As far as money around the house, so we have bank records. I've started to go through them. It's long and lots of pages. I've been through them all. I haven't seen anything that really jumps out at me yet, but I want to really analyze them. We also have credit reports, and they're complicated and don't really show much, but I want to try to be able to break those down to come up with some more solid conclusions. Similar with the cell phone evidence. You know, I've got lists of a bunch of numbers, but we really need to break down who's who and who called who when. Right. So, but I will say I did find in the bank records, in August of the year before, Vicky received a cashier's check for $9,000 and some change from Ron Friedley. So that supports what John's ex had said, that sometime in the fall last year, I think she said she thought it was October, that John gave her a check for $10,000 from the money, the first installment that they were owed from Ron. Well, we see it was about $10,000 that she got from Ron in the fall. Okay. So that was accurate. As far as money in the account, if they got the $175,000, if they did get that money, then it would have been cash, because I can tell you that it's not in the bank. So it's based on because there's some like late payments on their mortgage. It seems like they keep paying the mortgage like $39 less than it's supposed to be every month. Hmm. And so every month they end up getting a late charge because they're paying short.
That's interesting.
But based on some of that you're seeing and some of the things that I think I'm interpreting right on the credit report, it sure doesn't seem like they've got $175,000 laying around anywhere. And it certainly wasn't in the bank.
That's a substantial amount of money. You seem like that much money, there would be some sort of paper trail attached to it. Like you just can't go about that and just give it to somebody. I can't just give you $175,000 like without there being some notification of it.
Right.
There's no indication right now that that particular sum of money had ever actually made it to them, but that there had been a previous payment. Lynn just volunteered, not a question, but a pension payment to an ex-spouse is controlled by federal law, not a decision of the retired worker, an insurance company, which was Lori's question, or the employer. Vicky's could only be removed by her death. If Ron wasn't remarried, he could have married Vicky again to get his full pension, too. So some logistical stuff there.
Right. Yeah. And like I said, it was definitely the way it's supposed to be paid out is controlled by federal law, but the federal government's not doing it. It's not like someone from the federal government is taking money out of Ron's account and putting it into Vicky's. they have the ruling from their judge that says she has to give, or he has to give some of it to Vicky. And the basis for that, how it gets paid out, is based on this federal law telling John, like, there's no way around this. But that doesn't mean that he can't go and try to fight that ruling and try to fight, you know, appeal against not having to do so. But yeah, that's right. There's, you know, two ways he doesn't have to pay it. One is if Vicky dies, he doesn't have to pay it, because I don't believe in those circumstances, from what I was reading, that there is a survivor payout. Like, you know, well, if he owed it to her, and if she dies, then he has to pay it to the daughter. There's nothing like that in there. So if she's dead, he doesn't have to pay it. And yeah, if he remarried her, he wouldn't have to pay it.
Okay. Well, let's get into some of these past relationships that we were talking about. Kristen says, what do you know about Chuck? Do you have clarification on who Becky actually lived with in her senior year? And Amanda follows up with, does Chuck get interviewed by police?
From what I've seen, Chuck does not. I've searched through this file. I've read the reports. I've read through all of them. I have searched through the file for the words Chuck, Charles, anybody. I've not seen where Chuck is ever interviewed. As a matter of fact, we're still trying it. We have some listeners have done some research. And again, I want to stress, do not contact people connected to any case we're working on. These people didn't. I just want to make that clear. But they were doing some research. They had some resources and helped break some things down. Like, we know that Vicky was married prior to Ron. In 1974, she was married to a guy named Michael. I don't know how to pronounce the last name. It's like Goodrich, but it's spelled a little funny. And then Tiffany was born in 1975, and Michael is her father. Then they got divorced. They got with Ron. Tiffany said in one interviewer in court that, you know, it was like her and Ron were together. She was like 6 years old, and then they up and moved up to Pinyon Pines. Mm-hmm. So then there may have been another place in between there, but they moved up to Pinyon Pines when she was like six. And then the other two girls, Drew and Becky, are Ron's kids. And then they got divorced. Then came Chuck, the boyfriend. All we know is Chuck. I do know that Tiffany, at least, we heard mentioned that Tiffany was very close to him, and Becky seemed to be too. We know Chuck was very much a father figure and a grandfather figure to Tiffany and her children. He passed away in 2020, so Chuck is gone now. Still haven't figured out Chuck's last name or if he was ever interviewed. Doesn't appear to me. I didn't hear anything that made me think he would be a suspect. Mm-hmm. Somebody should be on the radar. It appears that he had just a wonderful, loving relationship with at least Tiffany and her children. But that's kind of how that timeline breaks down. As far as who she went to live with her senior year, it seems like it was Chuck. It was not her dad. Her friends thought it was her dad, which again then makes me wonder, did she see him as like a father figure? And then, you know, so what was her relationship with her dad like if she considered this boyfriend of her mom's to be the father figure?
That's a really good question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because Catherine even said, you know, I was wondering about the reason for Becky going to stay with her father. So now we're saying we don't even know that she was going to stay with her father. It could have been Chuck. Catherine says, was related to bad relationships at school or with her friends or to avoid the gang she might have been involved with, which I know we'll get into in a little bit. If so, this is quite a drastic, evasive step for her to take, so might shed light on why she was subsequently killed. But now you're saying we're not even sure that she was staying with her dad. It could have been Chuck.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Chuck. Okay, I don't think it was her dad. Yeah. But as far as why she moved out, the problem is, it seems that, so we have her friends saying she tends to bend the truth a little bit. And you also have them saying she said that that's her dad, or their impression was at least that that's her dad that she was staying with. And then, so the people that would really know why she moved down there, back down into the valley to stay with Chuck, would be Becky, John, and Vicky, probably, are the only ones that would really know. And of course, they're all gone.
Right. Megan asks the question I'm sure many people are asking, did the police ever interview Ron?
They did. Yeah. So yeah, it's not like they didn't investigate Ron. Ron was interviewed. Ron was polygraphed. He passed a polygraph. And we'll get into, I don't want to jump too far ahead because when we cover suspects, we'll deeply go into all this. But I do want to make clear. Yeah, Ron was interviewed. Ron was polygraphed. We'll get through the questions that were asked in that polygraph, what happened. But yeah, they did investigate him. But I will also say, just, there was a little bit of, I'll just give you an example. There's an interview with a neighbor who tell police, a friend of mine said they saw Ron down, because Ron didn't live in the valley. Right. He lived, I don't remember the city he lived in, but he lived a little ways away. and they said, a friend of mine said they saw Ron in the valley eating dinner at whatever restaurant on the Friday before the murders. And the cop just scoffs, literally scoffs off and goes, well, we know that's impossible. Hmm. And they move on. I'll tell you this. I haven't seen anything in the report that makes that impossible. Hmm. But it just gives it to me. It just gave a little, it seemed like, well, and we'll find out more when we dig more into it. But it was like, man, they really don't want to look that direction. I'll say this. The police are giving away way too much information in all these interviews when they should be listening. Right. They're constantly interjecting stuff on their own that they shouldn't be interjecting.
Since you brought that up, I want to talk about one thing before it gets totally lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, please.
And that is the fact of the wheelbarrow and how there are other people that knew about the wheelbarrow. Right. I think that was a big thing. Even though it was such a minute thing that was in this episode, I think that was a big thing that we now know that it wasn't just Javi's dad that knew about this or the police on the scene. There was multiple other people.
Yeah, we know at least two neighbors knew about it. Mm-hmm. And so from there, we have to say we don't know who else knew about it.
Well, I mean, I think those people would probably tell a lot of people. I know everyone keeps to themselves, yikes, that could spread quickly.
Well, and one of the neighbors is a parent to one of Becky's friends,
right,
which means it could have got to the friend circle that way as well.
Right.
So, I mean, that was a big thing. And I just want to make sure it didn't get lost in there because I feel like it could have been. Because it was such a small part of this episode, but I think that was huge.
You're so, so right. That's a big deal. You're absolutely right. So Teresa Harris Dunn did write a very long post on Facebook, a post maybe even too long to be able to fully cover and read in the follow-up, but lots of great stuff in there. Bob, do you want to kind of summarize and just sort of tie up this past relationship stuff that we've been talking about?
Yeah, I think that's where, Teresa, and I know Teresa's in the chat right now.
Hi, Teresa.
Great job. Lots of really well-thought information. You can't write a book in the follow-up thread because it's way too much for us to put on the show. It was really, really well thought out, but like about this long in the thread. But yeah, a lot of it is what I just kind of broke down before, which is, and actually Teresa helped find some of this information out that we knew about the previous marriage, who Tiffany's dad was, then Ron, then came Chuck, then came John. So that's the stuff I just broke down a few minutes ago is kind of a lot of what she was talking about there.
Okay.
and how that timeline breaks out.
Nice work, Teresa. And Brian, who I think also just popped in, he pointed out that, you know, how likely is it? I know you said that they kind of glossed over and didn't want to look in that direction, but Brian did point out, you know, Becky's his kid. And so how likely is it that he would even be involved when his own daughter was a victim?
I will tell you this. When I first started looking the case, I have people throwing all kinds of theories at me, and that was one of them. And my first thought was, I think the fact that Becky was murdered probably rules out her dad. Now, that was naive of me, and I'm not saying that I think there's a good chance Ron should even be a suspect. But he should be a person of interest, for sure. I think we all agree with it, just like Robert and everybody else should. We're early. But I started thinking back, and it's like, we've seen husbands kill wives and wives kill husbands and parents kill children and children kill parents over money thousands and thousands of times. So
if Becky wasn't supposed to be there.
Right. Yeah, exactly. We also have this possibility that Becky not only wasn't supposed to be there, but that she had left and come back. And then there's scenarios where, you know, and again, I hate him because I'm not suggesting any of this happened. I don't know enough to even begin to formulate a theory about how any of this would happen. But there's always a possibility that if there was some kind of involvement from Ron to try to stop this payment, that he would have maybe paid someone else to go do it or had somebody doing it for him. And then in that case, you could see how if that was, you know, if the plan was just to take out John and Vicky, Becky walks in on it, sees who it is, that she becomes collateral damage, where if maybe Ron himself was there, that wouldn't have happened. I don't know. But I guess my only response to that is I don't think that we can rule out the possibility of Ron's involvement simply because Becky's his daughter.
Okay. I just was scrolling back trying to make sure I didn't miss anything massive in the YouTube chat. And Emma did mention something that definitely stuck out to me, too, which was as much as he was saying he wasn't trying to be gross, the boss talking about how sexy Becky was just a very hard listen.
What a poor choice of words.
Oh, boy. He's like, not to be gross, but what a sexy, big-breasted girl. I was just like, oh, no, no, no. God, no.
Yeah.
Yikes.
There's been a lot of discussion about that on the fan page, and there have been people that have like defended, like, well, you got to remember the time, and no, he's an old man.
The time isn't an excuse. That was disgusting.
It was yucky.
I guess I'll say in his defense, I think that I don't think he intended that to be creepy. I think he intended it to be complimentary, but at the same time, damn, was that creepy.
Yeah. You know,
it was, I definitely was like, when I heard that.
Well, and also she's dead. And I don't know when these, I know that there's, because we know the Denny's people were not interviewed until 7 years later. Obviously we have a huge timeline issue happening with when people got arrested, what the investigation was doing for those 7 years. I know you're going to get into all of that, but we continue to have this recurring theme in the YouTube chat and in questions and comments of people just saying like, why does no one seem that bothered? And I would say that him talking about how sexy she was in a weird way sort of enforces that idea. And I don't know, is it just people kind of turning the emotion off to try to be helpful? Like, this is, I don't talk about how sad I am to the police. I tell them what could be useful. And I take that time privately to feel sad. But there's still some talk about that. And I get it, that people that being interviewed just still don't sound that troubled by this happening. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. And I see in the YouTube chat, Stephanie says there was no reason to leave that in. Sounds like she's pretty upset with me for doing that. These are all choices we have to make because I considered it. And I guess I'll default to what I've said many times before. If someone says something to the police, whether I agree with it or it's cringy or not, I think that it's they made the choice to say it and it needs to be in there because it in a way it becomes part of her victimology. You at least get to, you know, this is how a dirty old man looks at her.
Like a guy who's lonely at Denny's in the middle of the night also might say something similar. Yeah, I get it.
I made the choice, and I understand people may not like that, but I made the choice to leave it in, and it's part of the investigation. We don't get to just pick and choose what parts we like and don't like. You know, it becomes part of it.
Well, let's talk about the gang. That's that we've been dancing around it a little bit, but that was obviously something that came up in an interview and more than one interview, as it turned out, towards the end of your episode. What's going on there? Talk to us. Amanda wants to know, do we know anything about Becky's friends being involved in gangs? What's going on with this gang thing?
That's a weird thing that was like, it was not, from what I can see, it was not pursued by police. There's no, the gang unit never got involved in this case. There's no evidence that they were really looking into whether or not there was some gang involvement. It comes, so there's about seven interviews where people are talking about gang. I didn't play them all because a lot of them end up, they're all pointing back towards, you know, I heard from this person that she was in a gang and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So I go listen to that person's interview. And they're like, yeah, I heard she was in a gang, but it's like it turns into this like game of telephone. So a lot of them are pointing back to the same thing. But it's interesting that you have, you know, every time the police go to talk to somebody, somebody's like, I heard she was in a gang. But then they never ask about a gang. They never try to look into a gang, but they just keep hearing it.
But do they believe the gang side is far fetched?
Could be.
Because I feel like it's pretty far-fetched. I feel like that's just a lot of teenage drama that they put out there. A lot of times that happens where you see people talking and they're like, you know, I've seen it in here, like in our area, but they're like, oh yeah, so-and-so's in a gang.
Yeah, it can be racist too. It can be a racist place to go. It's not to say that it always is or that it's always wrong, but it can be a good catch-all.
Yeah, and I have no idea if it's accurate or not. We'll see that. So you have the, Alex was his name, was an ex-boyfriend that she dated, Becky dated between Robert and Jacob. And his mom, so there was, I don't remember how much of this made it into the episode, but Alex and his mom went up to the crime scene with flowers and talked to a bunch of the neighbors. I think we did hear of that talked about with one of the interviews we played. And the mom had told the neighbors that Becky had stopped by after they'd broke up. She had stopped by the house. She was talking. She's, you know, in the interview, she's like, she was there for a little while because I remember I fed her. She was really upset and her phone kept blowing up and she was crying. In that interview, the police didn't, again, they don't ask, well, what was she crying about? Who was it that was calling her? They jump into something else. So I never got to hear it directly from her because they never asked her who was it that was calling her. But there was two or three different neighbors that were on the scene talking to her that all said she told them that there were these gang members that won't leave her alone, and she was crying, and they kept calling her. So it becomes hearsay because it's interviews telling the police that they heard from Alex's mom that that's what happened. When the police interview her, she says she's confirming the story. She was there. The people were calling her. The phone was blowing up. She's crying. And they didn't say who was calling her. So we never hear it directly from her. But I mean, I have follow-up. So once we get past this part of it, when we launch into our new investigation, when we're done investigating the investigation, right. That's when, you know, I will probably try to reach out to some of these people and see if I can get an interview and get a little more clarification.
Okay. I'm going to move along just because it's my fault that I have a heart out, but I literally am getting into a car to get on a plane, which is
In 12 minutes.
Why we only have we have had an hour and we've used it. But gosh, this was such a packed full episode and so many great questions. Just to cover that last piece that was brought up by John's ex, Kristen says, do you have any further information on the people who bought the land that's attached to Vicky's property? That was obviously another thing that was posited as a possibility for revenge or whatever.
Yeah, I don't. I have land records. Actually, I've met the guy that owns the property next door. When I went up there at night one time to see what it looked like at night up there, the guy was up there with his dog and I chat. But he just bought it last year. It's changed hands a lot since then, so I haven't been able to track down records of who that was. It also seems that's, you know, again, it's on the list. All these, I want to point out to a guy named Chris Dolan, who's been on the show before. I love Chris. He's on the fan page a lot. We tend to not always agree on a lot of things, but we have some really good discussions. And he had pointed out, he's like, well, you said that this was, you know, far more important, the money and all this, than teenage drama. I don't think we should be ranking victimology. I want to point out that he's right. Maybe I had a poor choice of words, but to explain that is, in my mind, when I'm looking at all these different elements, for me, the alarm bells are going off. Take names and faces out of this. Someone owes her 175 grand that they don't want to pay her that goes away if she dies. That's a real significant victimology factor. As far as Robert as the ex, we don't have any actual evidence to support that he wanted her back or that he was jealous or even that he went on the hike. All we know is that he planned to go on a hike. Still could be a suspect. Hike still could have happened, all that. But so for me, that's what got my attention more. But I also want to make clear, when we get into actually doing a profile and the victimology is put into that profile, Jim Clementi will be coming on to do that, that you know, I'm not ranking these things to him. I'm going to give him the full list of them and let them just fall where they are.
Understood. So for the crime scene, just kind of coming back to that, that's a question from Kelly. Bottom line, yes or no question, how likely or unlikely do you think it was that Becky could have been burned in the wheelbarrow because she was... I hate even saying this, but could she have been raped? Could something have happened to her that would be a specific reason to want to destroy evidence?
We'll get into that stuff in the medical evidence episode, where we'll really dig into the report. But I'll say this. I believe the reason she was burned is just my theory. I think the reason she was burned was to conceal evidence. Yeah. To me, I see some criminal sophistication there. If there was some sort of a struggle, someone who knows, like, oh, I'm going to have my DNA and hair and stuff on her. I think that that's why she got lit on fire. But that's not necessarily the case, but that's just what I lean towards.
Normail asks, from Bob's experience as a fire investigator, what are the reasons that killers set fire to a dwelling after killing someone? I think you've talked a little bit about this. Could it cover up bullets? I know in this case it was said that the sex of the bodies couldn't be determined, but police knew they had been shot and even determined the shots came from two different guns. So still some question from Normail around the burning of the bodies.
Yeah, so when arson is used in a case like this, it's usually to do two things. One, it's to conceal a crime. You see a fire used to try to make something look like an accident. And then also you see fire to try to destroy evidence. You know, I've seen, you know, I've personally been on cases where someone was murdered and put in the trunk of a car, and then the car lit on fire. Well, the car wasn't lit on fire to hide the fact that there was a crime in that case. It wasn't to conceal the crime. It was obviously a crime. There's a body in the trunk of the car. The purpose for the fire was to burn away any evidence, any fingerprints, blood, DNA, anything like that, hair.
Gotcha. Catherine says, you said at the end of the episode that victimology analysis was complete. Does this mean that you are up to date on the relevant case files, which might shed light on victimology? Do we kind of know that all of the available information on potential risk factors has been covered or will be, where there'll be more that's revealed later. I guess if you find more, there'll be more.
Yeah. So, anybody that's been around for a long time, we do this all in real time. This is a dynamic, something I say today, I may tell you 3 weeks from now, I've changed my mind on that, or there's new evidence to suggest that that was wrong, what I said before. And that's not me flip-flopping. This is all happening in, we do a real-time crowdsourced investigation. When I said that we're done with victimology, everything that I found so far that I think is relevant for us to understand to move on to the crime scene, we have. There's a little more bits and pieces, nothing that I found very significant. I don't doubt that down the road, say when I call that Alex's mother, that maybe we get more information. That'll come down the road. So we'll always be circling back to it. We're never done. But as far as like production of episodes, I've gone through and I think that everything that we need to get out that can be produced into a full episode is done. And so now we're going to go ahead and move on to the crime scene. It does not in any way mean that we may not circle back and learn more about victimology. But I think that we've done enough that we can move to the next step.
Okay. And then the final thing I just want to kind of round up is seen a little bit of it in the chat, definitely a little bit of it in questions, is just kind of returning to this idea of Bob being objective versus subjective. Kate says, you know, this episode definitely introduced other potential suspects and motives, but I wish Bob would just concentrate on the investigation as an open investigation instead of focusing on how to cancel out the original investigation's outcome. She worries that maybe you're doing the same thing where you have tunnel vision of proving the cops are wrong. She points out that the intro, really just the intro of the episode, is where she felt like that was highlighted and that she could have done without the intro because it didn't make it sound as objective. And so, you know, there's just still people kind of talking about, well, do you even believe this could be a wrongful conviction? Have you already made up your mind? All that kind of stuff. If you just want to kind of put a button on where you're coming from when you say what you say and what your intention is, just maybe we can put that to bed for the rest of the season.
Yeah, sure. So I'll say, here's the thing. I tell you guys this every season. You either believe me or you don't. And I can't change that. But I will tell you the same thing. I'm very open-minded to this, to this case, any case. I can't tell you if Robert Pape was wrongfully convicted or not. Obviously, in my pre-screening of the case, it looked like there was a good chance that is a possibility. And now we're investigating it. And I'm presenting to you what I find as I find it. And I'm not trying to just cancel out the police initially. I will be certainly willing to tell you if I dug through the case file and was like, actually, it looks like they did a pretty good job here. I would tell you that, but they didn't. It's hard to argue they did in this case. And the way this works, like it or not, because there's still people that are like, well, I don't know why you don't give us all the case files in episode one. That's not, listen, 12 seasons, people. Like, if you like the show and you like the way we do it and you like being a part of a real-time investigation, this is for you. If you want a full case file to go run out and do on your own, there's other shows, you can find your own cases and do that with. That's just not the way that we operate. It's all for a reason. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time breaking all that down for you. It's the way we've done it for 12 seasons, over 1,000 episodes. We do it. This is the way we do it. So no, I'm not trying to just undo their investigation. I'm trying to find the truth in this case, in every case. I'm very objective and open-minded. If you guys were privy to some of the conversations I have in here with Zach and Mike when he was here, you know, when I have doubts or questions and working through things and then share them on the podcast as they come up. But as far as like that introduction and me saying, so this is the way this works. I research, I present evidence to you, and then I give you my opinion on the evidence. And then I do this episode to ask for your opinion on the evidence so we can hopefully through that conversation come up with the truth. And what you're asking is for me not to give you my opinion, not to say that, hey, this is not the only thing that was out there. They seem to be focused here, but I'm about to show you there was a whole bunch of stuff going the other way. That I'm not going to not do that. That's just not the way the show's ever worked. Not the way I operate. I saw a t-shirt the other day that I want to find that just says, I'm not for everyone. And that's me.
Every single one of us could wear a shirt like that and it would be true. That's just empirically true. Okay. Well, I'm glad that you addressed that. My goal, it's a small one, other than just wanting to always hear from Zap, because I love your perspectives and I love your thoughts on everything too, is to really not have to talk about that again. I really don't want to have to talk about that. I'm sure there are people who disagree. I'm sure there are people who agree, but I would love for this to be the last time that we have to directly address whether or not you are being biased or you're trying to push the evidence in a certain direction. I just don't think we have time for that. And so I'm hoping that, and so I don't think I'm going to read anything else like that again, unless it's specifically calling someone out, Jason or Chris, somebody who has a very specific reason why they're saying, I didn't agree with this particular piece of evidence that you said in this way. I always want to address that. But I feel like I just want to push past this idea of every single follow-up having to address whether or not you're biased. I just I don't want to do that anymore. So blame me if you're not, if your comment isn't read about that. I love you. I'm so sorry, but we're not for everyone.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And believe me, it has nothing to do with me like having my feelings hurt. It literally doesn't. I've been far enough into this to know that no matter what I do or say, when someone's still going to insist that I'm not going to change their mind. I don't care. You're welcome to feel that way, but we're not going to waste everybody's time who does like the way we do things to talk about how you don't like me or the way we do things. So they're just not going to do it.
Well, you know, I'll jump in here for a second and just say, you guys are going to believe that I'm Bob's cheerleader because that's what I'm here. I'm his friend. Everybody knows that. But I'm privy to a lot of conversations that you guys aren't outside of this. And I know what we go through. I know what Bob goes through. And we've had some challenging conversations ourselves off the air. Just because you guys do not hear them doesn't mean they're not happening.
Thank you, Zach.
And with that, Janet does have a hard out. I promised her by 1 p.m. Eastern time I'd have her out of here. It's 12:59.
Here I go.
So we will go ahead and wrap this thing up. But thank you all so much for tuning in and listening. And this week, we're going to hear finally about the crime scene. Make sure you tune in on Sunday. Thanks, Janet.
Thanks, everybody.
Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Edited by Mike Bussing, and all music for the show is created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by me, and all of our fonts across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Kay Woodyomnik, Ginger Fiola, Erica Cantor, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Ford, Courtney Wimberly, and Melissa Cardenas. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in several ways. To financially support the show, the best thing you can do is just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You'll not only be supporting the show, but you'll get something in return. On Patreon, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes bonus video content every week. Then other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also do us a huge favor by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the brands that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page on Facebook. And for all you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. Follow our personal accounts on social media. I can be found in all forms @BobRuffTruth. Janet can be found @JanetVarney. And Zach is @Z2TheQ. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. As for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.